You're listening to Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, coffee, cars, and mobile web development, hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator of Instapaper.com. I'm Dan Benjamin, creator 5x5, and this is December 27th, 2011, episode number 57. We have two sponsors, actually just one sponsor. It's like a holiday week, so even the sponsors get time off.
It's a Christmas miracle.
It is. It's Shopify.com. Thanks to them. We also want to say that Stitcher Smart Radio is providing the bandwidth for this episode. Hear all the shows from 5x5 and thousands of other great podcasts on demand on the go with Stitcher's free mobile app. Stitcher.com/5. It's one of your last chances to maybe win $100. Check them out. So how was Christmas at the Armitts?
I would love to maybe win $100.
I don't know how it works.
Neither do I. Christmas is pretty good.
Yeah.
To answer an immediate question from the chat room from Adam Wolf, how were sales of Instapaper? Double, triple, lots of new iPads.
Yeah. Lots of unboxing.
The answer is I have no idea, because iTunes Connect shuts down every Christmas for the holidays. iTunes Connect shuts down around Christmas every year for about a week. And I have it on my calendar when it starts up again. I think it's on Thursday. It actually can really, developers, I know this is not helpful to you now, but last week you might have been able to use this information. If you're planning like a one-day sale or something, you shouldn't schedule that anywhere near the shutdown, because when iTunes Connect is shut down, you can't edit your app. You can't submit a new version. You can't change the description. And importantly, you can't change the price. So I've seen a few developers get caught and like accidentally either miss a release date or accidentally have a discount last a lot longer than they wanted it to.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have no idea how sales have been yet. I know my rank has climbed because the rank data is still being updated as far as I can tell. So I'm doing well in the ranks, but I have no idea what that means for sales, and I won't know until probably Thursday or whenever that day is that they reopen it. Traditionally, Christmas Day and the few days following it have been very good to me in the past, because normally anytime there's a lot of new iOS devices sold, those people all go and look for apps because they want to, you know, they start using these devices. They want to fill them up. They want to get good stuff. Maybe if they've been waiting for it, they might have already heard of some apps that they want to go try. So traditionally, Christmas Day is very good. Not iPhone launch days can be good, but they're not nearly as good because people buy iPhones on contracts. So they don't all go and buy them on the very first day. But anything that causes a lot of sales of iPads and iPod Touches is predictably very good for app developers. So, I guess Adam Wolf, I could look at server logs, but I'm not. I don't have really anything in place to tell me that quickly, so I'll just wait till Thursday.
Yeah.
Also, to answer another question earlier in the chat, where was that? From Swilliams, is one of your topics how I pounded you in strategery over Xmas? ?/D. Yes. So it turns out strategery is awesome, even multiplayer. This game, it was one of the very first games I ever got for the iPhone, like back in 2008 when the App Store started. Strategery is awesome. We'll put it in the show notes. It's kind of a simplified Risk style game that's really well done. And it turns out even before Game Center existed, they were doing their own kind of mass asynchronous turn-based service. So kind of similar to Words with Friends, where you can have a bunch of games going at once and you're just waiting for people to move.
Mm-hmm.
It has that mechanic. So over the break, I was really bored one day. So I think it was on Christmas Eve day. We were up at family and I couldn't really do anything. So I had a lot of time spent on my iPad. So I tweeted saying, hey, anybody want to play Puerto Rico HD? And I got one person who could play it. No one else has heard of that game, even though I talk about it periodically. So it turns out no one else has heard of Puerto Rico, the board game, or the iPad version of it. So only one person could play that. But then someone's like, hey, I'll play you in Strategery instead. So I went and looked and, you know, launched that, because I've had it, you know, forever, but I haven't played it in a while, and didn't realize they had multiplayer at all. So yeah, turns out It's awesome. And I had like 60 games going at once. Because I tweeted later, hey, challenge me there. My name there is Marco Arment. And yep, sure enough, tons of inbound requests. Said yes to all of them. And was playing that. There's still like 60 moves I have to make that now I'm just out of time because now I'm home and back to the daily grind of being a professional podcaster.
And this is called Strategery.
Yes.
It's $2.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's totally worth it. It is probably... I'm almost certain that it is the game that I have spent the most cumulative time on iOS. I think maybe Wordle, but I got burnt out on Wordle after a while and I just switched to Strategery. Yeah, probably my most cumulatively played game. Very, very good. Anyway, and more people should play Puerto Rico because it's an awesome board game. Do you play board games, Dan?
Chutes and Ladders and Candyland mainly.
Those sound like very strategic games.
You know, they're more complicated than you might think. But that's, if I'm playing a board game, that's what it is.
Isn't Chutes and Ladders entirely decided at the beginning of the game?
No.
Because don't you draw cards to move?
There are, well, maybe in the version of Chutes and Ladders that we have, which by the way is the superheroes one with the Marvel superheroes. There's just a spinner. There's just a spinner, and you move the pieces around based on the number of...
Okay.
You know, so 1 to 6, so you move one space or two.
But it's still like, do you ever have to make a decision?
You not really. You're just spinning. But for the 3 or 4 year olds, that is a decision.
I guess that's true.
You'll know soon enough.
What I like about Puerto Rico is that there's only one element of the game that's random, and it's a really inconsequential element for the most part. Like it's the selection of the plantation tiles. That is random. And even then you have some saying which of those you pick. So it's mostly based on strategy. Like it's mostly just your decisions get you to where get you to the outcome, and that's it. So we got a lot. And some quick FU for the talk show. First of all, that was a hilarious episode.
Seems to be a crowd favorite.
It was awesome. Laughing my ass off. Anyway, not right now. I was laughing my ass off. And quick follow-up. John Gruber said that he was talking about the power switch design of the Kindle Fire and how right now it's a push button on the bottom edge so that when you're holding up the Kindle Fire, if you set it down on a table or like on yourself, on your lap, when you're reading... If you let the bottom edge rest on anything, it turns the power off.
That seems like that's
terrible design.
That can't be possible. That can't really be it.
Right.
Can't really work that way.
And also, the software update that came out for the Kindle Fire, it did improve performance, but performance was just one of the problems with the device. It still has a lot of problems. Some of them can't be fixed in software. Like I think the lack of hardware volume buttons and a hardware home button really hurts. Especially the volume buttons, those omissions are great, and that matters a lot. That can never be fixed in software, and the other software problems are much bigger issues. Like the entire OS is full of rough edges. Like that's something that's hard to sand down quickly.
Yeah.
You know, ask Google with Android that ships to on phones. Like that's not an easy task to do, and it's not going to happen with a quick sub point update 2 weeks after the thing's launch. And traditionally, Kindles get very few software updates. So I wouldn't be surprised if the Kindle Fire a year from now is almost identical to the Kindle Fire we know today. You know, assuming no new hardware, which might not be a safe assumption, but you know, assuming, talking generally about the software, I think the software on the Kindle Fire today is going to look and work almost identically to the way it will look and work a year from now. Because Amazon just doesn't really care that. You know, they care to get their software good enough on the Kindles and then they just leave it like that. Anyway, minor follow-up there. Gruber had said that the e-ink Kindles solve this problem by having solve the power switch problem by having a slider switch. That isn't true anymore. The Kindle 2 and 3 had sliders. The 2 was fine because the switch was on top, just like the iPhone, where like the switch, the sleep wake switch is on top of, on the top edge,
right?
The Kindle 5 or the Kindle 4 and Touch have the Switch, and the 3 for that matter, all have the Switch on the bottom. The 3 had the slider switch, but even that I found pretty easy to accidentally hit. Like if I'm like wearing jeans and you have like the big pants bubble by your crotch and you like rest the thing down there, like, you know, you could very easily hit that. But now they all have push buttons. And I haven't used them long enough to really know whether I hit them a lot accidentally in practice. So far I haven't. But I think part of that is because the one I'm using mostly, the Kindle 4, the cheap one, is very lightweight and very small. So I tend to hold it up from the surface. I don't usually rest it on something.
Right.
It's so light. I don't use a case with it or anything. It's so light that you can comfortably hold it in midair without resting it on something. So anyway, that's my Kindle follow-up for the episode, I hope. I'm sure they sold a bunch of these things for Christmas, but I'm really curious to see, you know, if people's opinions change, if people start saying, wow, this is a great device, I'm so glad I have it, in meaningful numbers, because so far that hasn't happened yet. So far, all the press reviews have been mediocre at best, usually negative. You know, this isn't just me being a fanboy here. This is like, you know, everybody saying this thing is not that great. But I'm really curious to see how this ages and what we're saying about the Kindle Fire in 6 months. Have you tried one yet?
I still have not had an opportunity to try one, unfortunately.
Oh, it's a piece of junk. You're missing nothing.
Well, I still would like to be able to evaluate it.
No, it's relevant at least. Like it's the kind of thing that it's a big enough deal in our industry, we think, assuming that sales figures and everything are all strong. It's a big enough deal that it's worth it to just check it out to know what people are talking about and to decide for yourself whether this is something you need to care about or not. Anyway, at the end of last episode, I mentioned a huge list of topics that we never get to. And I kind of ran through them in like, you know, 5 seconds each, yeah. Kind of listing what some of them were. And we got a bunch of feedback on that. At least 2 emails. So a whole bunch of feedback on that. One of the biggest ones people wanted to talk about, and this is a fairly quick one since you hate music, is music to listen to while coding.
I don't hate music, but...
Yes, you do.
I sure don't.
How many songs do you have in iTunes right now?
Do you think that how many songs I have in iTunes is a good indication of whether I like music?
It's often correlated.
I don't think so at all. What if I was an 80-year-old man who played piano and had my entire life and taught and yet had no computer? Would you say that I don't like music?
Well, that's, I think, a little different. I think it's safe to assume that since we are on a podcast...
Not true. I don't like to buy music very much through iTunes. I don't...
So you pirate everything?
No, I don't pirate anything at all. So that's why I don't have much music. I have, you know, there are great radio stations here in Austin, which I enjoy listening to. I listen to a lot of classical music, which is usually easy to find and very, very inexpensive. You know, I have music that I buy... It's usually music that my kid likes. So there's a lot of hard rock, which is what he's into. Stevie Ray Vaughan, AC/DC. That's the stuff he likes to listen to. So that's probably what you would find in our iTunes. That and all of the old CDs that I bought when I was, you know, in college and in my 20s. Not much.
No, that's too
bad.
But
I absolutely love music. I play classical guitar and have for many, many years. I learned when I was in high school. I also self-taught myself based on that how to play, I guess what you'd call hard rock, like Zeppelin and stuff, and Les Paul. Before that, when I was a kid, I learned how to read music by playing the trumpet. I played the trumpet in the little thing, never quite well enough to be a band nerd, but I absolutely love music. My grandmother played and taught piano, so there's a... You know, my grandfather had a jazz collection of, you know, old jazz and big band that was hundreds and hundreds of albums. So I was very well schooled on that. Absolutely love music. So I don't think that correlates at all with what kinds of music or if I have music in my iTunes as far as if I like music. I absolutely love music.
You just never listen to it.
I certainly don't listen to it when I was writing code or writing, you know, that's a distraction that I never... really thought was helpful to me. When I would listen to music and try to listen to music, especially if I had to like block out sound. Like I'd work in an office and people would be making noise and, you know, you want to block that out. What worked best for me, and I wish that there had been apps and stuff like there are today, but what worked much, much better for me would be white noise. I'm a strong believer in white noise. If you don't want absolute silence, and by the way, absolute silence is detrimental to human beings. Silence is really, really a bad thing for people.
Really? Why?
The human mind, the way that the mind-ear connection works, silence is perceived even in an unconscious way, certainly by animals, but also by human beings as well. Silence is perceived as danger. There is no state in the natural world that where things would ever really be silent, at least not in a way that most human beings would live in. Of course, you can say, oh, well, what about the Eskimos living in silence in the igloo? Okay, fine. Maybe they had some silence. I'm talking about for the majority of human beings. Silence is not something that typically happens in nature. At nighttime, the environment is absolutely filled with noises. All you have to do is watch, you know, National Geographic Channel or something, and you'll hear, you know, these guys who go and live with like the tribal people of whatever. Nighttime is bugs and insects and noise and things. If all of a sudden that stopped and got dead silent, what does that mean? Predator. And the human mind is conditioned.
Or you put on a pair of closed headphones.
No, you don't have those. You're living in nature. And what that means is that,
that sucks.
Human beings, so what you're doing by sitting in silence or creating silence or even worse, sleeping in silence, is what you're actually doing is you're creating a state for your mind to enter into instinctually and subconsciously a state that it perceives danger. This is one of the reasons people don't sleep well. This is one of the reasons that people find it difficult to, many people will tell you they don't like to sit in silence. That's because we're programmed by nature, by our own physiology, to not do well in silence. It actually heightens our awareness. It heightens our state of mind, which you might say is a good thing, but it actually creates stress conditions. It actually makes you feel, especially over the long term, much more stressed out. This is something I've researched a lot. And so silence is a bad thing. So you don't want silence. You don't want to be in silence. So I recommend, they actually, you know, you can get a, there's a great app that I have. It's actually called White Noise. You can control the kind of noise. It's not just, when people hear white noise, they always think of that sound, you know, like that sort of, what some people might even say was annoying, just sort of hiss sound. Well, there's a lot of variations of white noise. There's one called brown noise, for example, but you can also pick things like, you know, chimes going or an ocean sound or rain or a fan or an air conditioner, the sound of a plane, all of those. It's just such a great app. They have it for iOS and for in the Mac App Store. So you can play something like that in the background. If you don't want to listen to music. And what's also nice is that especially if your environment is a little bit noisy, those kinds of sounds completely mask the sounds around you without being loud. So you don't have to turn your music up to not hear the bozo in the next cue. So that's what I recommend.
So you don't listen to music while coding?
No, never. It's just a distraction. I used to in my 20s, a lot of Beastie Boys.
Oh, man. Oh, they're so bad. So, whoa, you hear that?
I did not. What was it?
All right, good. That's a very loud piece of tape. A lot of people really enjoy listening to music while coding, myself included. And I think
most people I know.
One big reason for this is it seems in our industry, possibly in every industry, but I don't really know about any other ones. The open office is very common.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not talking about the .org office suite that's really slow on Macs. And yeah, you know, not talking about that.
Not that.
You know, the open office arrangement where everyone, you know, nobody really has their own offices, or like, you know, most employees don't, you know, with walls and a door that closes. I think most coders work in an environment where they're in a cubicle or they're in one of those big long rows of desks that just have like little short dividers between them, like a little 2 foot thing, or even those little like 6 inch things. Those are really sad. I chose not to work at Bloomberg partially because of their awful desks. Anyway, Sorry for anybody who was listening who works at Bloomberg. So one of the easiest ways to concentrate in an open office environment is to put on headphones and listen to stuff.
Right.
And it blocks out, you know, good headphones at least. I wrote a blog post about this a few days ago. I really enjoy what's typically called circumoral closed headphones. And what that means basically is headphones that have a closed back, so they don't let a lot of sound or air in or out. And circumoral means they rest around the ear, like they press directly against your head. They, in theory, don't push on your ear itself. So, you know, like the big kind of headphones, the kind that, you know, some people choose to wear outside, but you look kind of weird if you do. And, you know, they frequently come in the quarter inch jack on the end.
Right.
Because they're really meant for like home use. I love closed headphones. And, you know, if you can put these on, like my preferred pair is the Sennheiser HD 280 Pro. And although I'll tell you what, the 380 Pro, I just got that. It's really good. That might become my preferred pair. It's a little too early to say. But anyway, the 280 or 380, the 280 is like $75. It's great because you can put these things on. They last forever, first of all. And you know, they're good headphones. But when you're working, you can put these on and play music at even a moderate volume and hear nothing from the room around you. And so if you can concentrate listening to music instead of listening to the office, you know, usually most people can concentrate better, you know, listening to music. It's a constant volume. It's something they expect. There's nobody like kind of shouting for their attention. So that tends to increase concentration for a lot of people.
I want to ask you a question that's on a tangent before,
sure.
Not to derail you, just sort of mark the question and then please continue and get around to it.
Gladly.
Why do you think that the open office spaces are so popular? But go back to it. Just work it in.
I'll get to that. So what you mentioned earlier, though, is relevant, which is you said, I believe you said, that lyrics distract you. Is that true?
I mean, they can. They can. You know, I mean, it's...
A lot of people say that.
You want to listen to something that... If there are lyrics, in a way, it's like somebody's talking to you or singing to you, right? Whereas if it's just instrumental, then you can... It is somehow a little bit less to focus on.
I found, generally speaking, I found that, you know, people tend... Like, either you listen to lyrics in music or you don't.
Right.
And people who listen to lyrics a lot get really irritated when the lyrics are stupid. So that's like, those people tend not like Phish, because Phish's lyrics are usually really stupid and or silly, you know, or just nonsensical, at least to me. Maybe some people understand them. I sure as hell don't. I don't listen to lyrics, really. I don't pay attention to lyrics. Like, songs I've heard a million times, I couldn't tell you what the lyrics were. I can tell you how they sound, but I can't tell you what the lyrics, what, you know, what they're actually saying. And even the ones where I can detect the words and kind of mentally process them, I'm hearing the words, but I'm not even listening. I'm not even trying to process those words in my head and say like, oh, that's what he's saying? That's kind of weird. Like, I don't even listen on that level. So
are you a musician? Do you play any
instruments? Growing up, I was in band and stuff, but now I don't do anything.
Do you think that has something to do with it? That maybe if you become, even as a kid, if you're a musician in some way, that it there's like a dynamic that it changes your, you know, maybe the change shifts your focus a little bit to hear the music maybe as much or more than a lot of people. I'm with you. I don't hear the lyrics quite the way that a lot of people I know. They just memorize all the lyrics. I'm like, wow, I always wondered what that line was.
Right. I mean, I don't know what the reason is for my enjoyment of music while coding. All I know is that I really do enjoy it a lot. Part of it's just, I really enjoy being in the headphones, being in the closed off environment where I can block out noise distractions more easily from the outside world. I mean, typically if I wasn't like a Tumblr, especially if I wasn't wearing headphones, I wasn't working very hard. Like I could leave my headphones off and like, process email and crap like that, you know, go through like kind of mindless tasks. But if I was really coding something, if I was building something or trying to debug something, working on something difficult and in depth, I was always in my headphones. And I know, so, you know, I know like Adam Wolf just said in the chat room, there's this big blob. I don't have time to read it all right now, but there's been a lot of studies done that kind of say, well, sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just a distraction. I really can't explain the reasoning. All I know is that I work better when listening to music. And so, and a lot of people say that too. And a lot of people say they have to have music without lyrics because they listen to the lyrics and they distract them. Like you said a few minutes ago, it's like they're talking to you.
Right.
That's never been a problem for me. I don't, whatever causes that processing in your head, I don't have that. So that part's fine with me. What distracts me though is big jumps in the music, like big shifts, like a bad shuffle. And this is a critical reason why I listen to what I listen to. I hardly ever listen on shuffle. I can't remember the last time I played iTunes on shuffle. I listen to albums. And critically, I listen to jam band shows too. And the reason why I listen to these things is because there tends not to be major jumps, like bad cuts from one song to another. Like the songs tend to flow in a way that somebody thought about. Usually it's the same band playing for a while. So, you know, that helps one thing. And it's not like a drastically different level of volume. It's not picking some random song that's really bad and or like a funny song. Like if I'm listening, if I'm coding and I'm concentrating on something, like a difficult problem, and then Vanilla Ice comes on, like that's, I'm going to lose concentration for at least a second to hit the skip button. So like there's those issues too. So what I like about full albums is, you know, the continuity helps. I also just like the album as an art form. Like I enjoy listening to 40 minutes of music instead of 3 minutes of music. Like that's just what I like. And the reason I like jam bands so much and their live recordings is because you can put on a jam band show. Like you can put on a Phish show and not touch it for 3 hours. You can hit play and not think about your music. And that is really great while working, because that means for that 3 hour span, unless you really hate one of their songs, for that 3 hour span, you won't have to hit track skip. You won't have to think about, oh, what I want to play next? What am I in the mood for now? What do I want to hear? Oh, I've heard that one too much recently. That one sucks. You can just not think about it and enjoy what's playing without paying so much attention to it. Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. It's something that you can kind of set, but that takes preparation, right? I mean, it takes time for you to say, what kind of playlist do I want? Do I want this whole album of jam bands? Do I want a couple different ones? Do I want a lot? You know, you've got to set the time aside to create that library, to set things up just right. And then after you've listened to the first 2-3 jam band albums like 20 times, you got to go find more. There's no variety.
Well, there's a few different factors there. One is that when I choose new music, I'm choosing it in 40-minute to 3-hour chunks at a time. So when a lot of people hear a new song they like, they'll go buy just that song. Then they've increased the music collection by 4 minutes. When I hear a new song I like, I'll go check out the album, and if the album's good, I'll buy the whole thing. So I've increased, you know, with not that much more effort, I've increased my music collection there by 45 minutes. If it's a live band or a live show, it's even better. Then I can increase it by like 3 hours. And then jam bands are really like, their shows tend to vary a lot. Not always, but they tend to vary a lot. And they tend to also put a lot of them up for downloading and buying. So by liking Phish as much as I do, which in this case is a very good thing, because by liking Phish as much as I do, I can download every single one of their shows. And I do. I buy them. There's livefish.net or .com. I think it's .net. I buy every single one of their shows. I pre-order them. It's great. There's new one coming out. Or a new 4 coming out this week because they're doing a New Year's Eve show. because I like the band so much and I like all their shows, I just get all of them. So every few months when they go take a tour, my music collection increases by like 15 hours of music, which is great. And they vary enough that I can go in the middle of a tour and hit play and it'll just keep playing. And then 8 hours later, I take my headphones off. I'm done for the day. It's still going. Then I just hit pause and come back the next day. So it's really great to not have to think about it. And it's also to answer the people in the chat room who are saying, well, you know, how much do I really like the band if I like not paying attention to them? No, I do like the music a lot. And I really do like, I like rocking out with that music, but I don't need to constantly pay attention to it to say, oh, this song sucks. Let me skip it. Let me find the next one. You know what? I don't have to keep messing with it. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to kind of ask that question. People were saying, well, is that what you would listen to? In other words, is this just background music for you, or is this the music of choice that if you're driving in your car or no computers were around and you were just listening to music, maybe reading or something, would you put it on as opposed to actively listening to music, listening to music as the primary activity? I think that's what I thought of Sakobai. Yeah.
Yeah. It's both. I listen to Phish a lot. I listen to jam bands a lot. I don't really distinguish. Like, most of the time, music that I like to listen to while working, that's what I also want to listen to when I'm not working, because that's what I like. So I don't really distinguish. When I'm doing something like driving where I need to be kept awake for a while, usually I listen to your shows. Not this one, because that's weird, but I listen to, you know, podcasts. Because I like that.
Yeah. No, it makes sense.
Like walking the dog, I listen to podcasts. You know, I'm doing shows, doing housework. We'll put on podcasts while we're, you know, eating meals and stuff. Instead of, because we don't want to watch TV while we're eating, because there's just no comfortable way to do it with our setup. But, you know,
You need some old-fashioned TV trays for your TV dinners.
No, we're gathered around the radio, the old-fashioned iPhone speaker dock.
I can see that. Oh, let's do our first sponsor. Then I want to talk to you about this offices thing.
Absolutely.
Tapfolio. It's an easy and beautiful way to look at stock markets. A lot of our listeners care about this, and they should. What does it let you do? Tapfolio lets you create a simple watch list or start a real or a mock portfolio in just a couple seconds. It's a touch experience for your iPad, rendered in glorious OpenGL. Tapfolio's third update has just hit the App Store, and they've got a bonus. It's free for the holidays. So they want you to go to facebook.com/tapfolio. That's where they would like for you to go, and you can check it out there. It's a very, very cool app. And thanks very much to them for helping make the show possible. So you worked at a number of companies.
Oh, one more thing.
Yeah.
I think it was Adam Wolf in the chat said...
He
can't understand how people can listen to podcasts while they work. So I like listening to music that I don't have to pay attention to constantly while I'm working. Podcasts are the opposite of that. Podcasts, like... I'm the kind of guy, I want to listen to every single episode all the way through. I don't want to miss a word. So like, if I'm listening to a podcast while walking the dog and someone comes up who I want to say hi to, I will pause the show and take my headphones off and talk so I don't miss anything in the show. Similarly, like, I'm the same kind of, like, I think that goes kind of hand in hand with the kind of people who read every tweet or who read every RSS item.
Right.
I've always been one of those people. If you do that, then I think you can't listen to podcasts while you work, because unless you have a different attention ability than I do. For me, if a podcast is on and I'm at my computer, I'm not listening to it. It might be playing, but I'm not paying any attention at all to it.
Right.
Same thing with videos. I can't watch a video while working. Some people can do that. I really, really can't. And EL Beavers said, right now, listening to this live, it's nearly impossible for me to get anything accomplished. That's why I don't listen to any of your shows live. Because A, I'm not going to sit at my computer and pay attention to a podcast. And B, if I have to get up for a second and go do something, I can't pause it and come back and resume where I left off. So I always wait to hear them non-live, you know, just download it into iTunes.
Right.
Anyway, so that's why, like, I think if you're listening at a computer, if you can pay attention, awesome. Congratulations. I can't do that. I suspect most people are not paying as much attention as they think they are. But maybe that's just me generalizing based on my own, how my own brain works. I don't know.
Some people also, I think, like a certain kind of background noise, whether it's human voices or music or whatever. And maybe they almost want to kind of tune it out a little bit. I don't do that. I don't know.
It's possible. I mean, yeah, everyone's different. But yeah, I really don't. I can't do that. So, offices.
So there is
not been Microsoft, you know, the other kind.
not Microsoft Office, but the right. actual physical thing. There have been there's been this trend, and it's been over the last I don't know, more than 10 years to move away from, you know, the ideal and old school scenario is you've got a floor or multiple floors or maybe even a whole building. And everybody has their own office. Ideally, it has a window, it has a door, and there are meeting rooms spread around, break rooms, that kind of thing. That's the old school style of an office. And even if you're brand new in a company, maybe not if you're like an intern, but if you're like a new person fresh out of college, well, you know, welcome and let me show you to your office. And you know what? It might be the smallest office. You might not have the window or you might not have the good view, but certainly you have an office. I mean, when I started working, I mean, my very first job, I did not have that. We had cubes, and that's the second stage. The second stage is you have rooms. They're not too big. Everybody has cubes. The cube walls are relatively high. Everybody's seen the movie Office Space if they haven't worked in the corporate world. And that's it. And hopefully you're not right up against the printer or right next to the water cooler. And the people surrounding cubes aren't too noisy, and you can pretty much, you know, get your stuff done. But then there's this trend that happens, where they have these open offices, that are, almost like that room that you would have had the cubes in, but much more modern design, much more open. Instead of having cubes exactly, there are just these sort of desks just sitting out there in the room. Or in some places, maybe there are little quadrants where you might have four desks all sort of facing open and open to each other. And so this has been the trend. Now, you've worked at places like that. Yep. And at least one of those cases, I would think you were one of the early employees. So maybe you would have had a choice maybe in...
Nope.
No? So what do you think is the trend moving? I mean, obviously, space utilization, using space more effectively, that makes sense as to why you might say, well, why would we give this guy his whole office when we could pack five people in there? Let's pack them in. So I get that space is an issue, and that's why for many, the concept of the independent office is gone. Private office is gone or going away, at least for regular employees. But what is this open office thing? What does that do? Why do you like that? First of all, can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think, well, let's first talk about why it's done. And then we can talk about pluses and minuses. You know, why it's done, the big, big reason is cost. It's really, really a lot cheaper. Office space, depending on where you are, it can be very expensive.
Cheaper to do to do open than to have cubes, you mean?
Oh yeah, by far, because you can fit a lot more people into the same square footage, and you don't have to buy all those cubicle walls and everything. Those things are expensive.
Yeah, they are.
Like the whole category of office furniture is surprisingly expensive. Like, you ever have one of those whiteboards that has the wheels on it, so you can roll it around and bring it to different people's desks?
Yeah, I know what you're talking
those
about.
Those cost like $1,500. Like, you wouldn't believe how expensive office furniture is. And it's the kind of thing, it's like, you can't really go on a website and see a price for a lot of it. You got to, like, call and get a quote and give them, you got to tell them how much money you have so they can decide how much they can charge you. It's crazy how much that stuff costs. So anything they can do to buy less furniture is an immediate savings right there. Square footage is a huge, huge deal, especially in big cities like here in New York. Square footage is very expensive. So anything you can do to reduce the square footage per employee helps. It's also, I would imagine, I don't know this for sure, I would imagine it's probably cheaper and more efficient to heat and air condition one big room than it is to do it for a bunch of individual offices. That's just a guess, though.
Mm-hmm.
But largely, it's just square footage savings and furniture savings. There's also other weird things, like if you have a floor plan where, let's say you have like a typical a New York brownstone shaped building, like a row house, where you have windows on like the front and back of the floor, but not on the sides, like a long, skinny office space. And this is one of the, I think this is one of the reasons why you hear so much about these open offices from startups and new young companies or just small companies, because small companies tend not to have entire buildings and entire floors, where you have windows on all four sides. Like if you're in a city, you probably have windows on one or two sides of your office, and that's it. So anyway, all that interior space that's not near the windows, if you're building offices with walls and everything, you really can't use that space for much because you don't really want an office with no windows. And you can do hacks like you can have the office that has no exterior windows but has a window to the rest of the office. You know, like the glass pane next to the door that just faces out into the rest of the office or the hallway. You know, you can do hacks like that to kind of get around this, but it's really, you know, it's tough to effectively use a lot of floor plans that don't have windows on all four sides and no interior. It's one of the reasons why buildings tend to put the elevators and stuff in the middle because you can't do anything else with it. But still, even if you have you put all the elevators, the kitchens and the bathrooms and the supply closets, all those in the middle, you still tend to have a lot of space that isn't next to a window. So the open plan, no one gets the window, really. Typically, the window is like a hallway or like a walkway area that you can walk through. Or you have a few desks next to the window from people who are really important or really lucky, and that's it. It's all basically just to save money and to be more practical. Like, it isn't necessarily evil. Like, companies don't have infinite money. They have to stay in business. They have to be able to pay their employees. They have to be able to hire new employees. So, a lot of times that's just the only affordable way to operate. Like Tumblr was done that way. As far as I know, it still is. Where it's just like a big open floor. There's not even, I don't even think there are walls or there might be short dividers between some of the desks now, but it's not even cubicles, like not even that level of walls. Just because, a startup has limited funds and everything. And especially in the very early stages, when you don't really know if it's going to work or not, you got to save money where you can. So that whole thing about startups, the whole myth about buying ping pong tables and having all these fun office parties and ridiculous waste of money with VC money. Honestly, I haven't seen that happen in our industry. Maybe that happened a lot more in the first dot-com wave, like in 2000. In the startups I've been in, they've never had that tremendous, crazy waste of money office. Have you ever seen one of those in real life?
I have not seen one in real life.
I believe they exist. The movie version of startup, or like the Time Magazine version of startup offices, where they have some big fountain in the middle and there's a ping pong table and a bowling alley all in the office, and no one seems to be getting any work done. Like an actual office. This was always funny when people would come to visit the Tumblr office. I would usually try to talk them out of it. Like, look, it really isn't that exciting. You know, like whatever you think the Tumblr, if you're like a Tumblr user and you love Tumblr so much, whatever you think the Tumblr office is like, you're probably going to be disappointed with the real thing. Because, especially when it was early and we were just sharing off with somebody else, like the Tumblr office was about 10 desks with about 10 people sitting at them wearing headphones and looking at their computers.
So then I have to ask really you this hard. Then if cost is the issue, or if it's one of the issues, Wouldn't it be cheaper then to, instead of renting a room that's large enough for 10 desks, rent a room that's large enough for one conference table, or even just rent a conference room for an hour a day or an hour a week and have everybody work from home and pay for their internet and pay for their phone and pay for their computer, but say, look, you guys can work from home. You want to work at a coffee shop? We'll get you a laptop. You can go work at the coffee shop. You can work wherever you want to work. We'll pay for, you know, we'll pay $50 a month for your internet connection, and we'll, you know, pay for whatever your phone bill is. And we'll give you the tools that you need to work from your house or wherever you would choose to work. And that, to me, that's way cheaper. I mean, I've done the math on this, and I've been in the situation to make that decision before. And I had the decision made essentially for us by saying, no, we want to have an office because that's what the investors want. So I see that there can be a reason to not do that. But, you know, I'm not saying have a completely virtual team that where everyone's in a different city. I'm saying even if they are in the same city, give them a place to go and meet so that it's really easy to meet, really easy to go and sit and see each other and work together if you want to several times a week or maybe even every day. But if money was really the issue, working from home is gonna way beat the cost of getting an office every time.
I mean, that's a whole other discussion, the whole idea of working from home and having remote employees. I am not at all qualified to talk about that because I've never done it. I've never been a remote employee. I've never had remote employees. So I really have no idea what that's like.
I've done both. I've been one, and I've had remote employees. I have been a remote employee for, you know, before starting 5x5, I was a remote employee for a Rails hosting company. I was, before that, I spent a year or two as a remote employee of a startup in San Francisco. And before that, I was a remote employee for another company, kind of intermixed with running my own business here and there, doing consulting and taking a year or two to do, you know, something else. But I was for many years. And I know that the from a cost standpoint, if you look at, especially, I can only imagine how expensive it would be in New York.
Oh, it's crazy.
But in even BFE kind of cities, you know, if you want to get space that's going to be big enough for 10 people with 10 desks and file cabinets and computers, and you want to get a fast internet connection, and you want to pay for electricity, you know, and you want to have some kind of build out so that you're not just standing on, you know, bare concrete with no walls, you know, and all of that. I mean, people, I don't know if they realize how expensive that proposition is, but it's not $1,000 a month. It's thousands and thousands and thousands. And in New York, I'm sure it's even more. Compare that with the probably $500 it might cost to get everybody an internet connection. So that, to me, I've often heard that, oh, that it's cheaper to do it like this. I just find, so let's get back to the issue of the whole office thing. How did you feel about working in that kind of environment sitting as one of the 10 people, you know, at a desk with headphones on, staring at maybe the back of somebody else's shirt all day or whatever? I mean, did you like that?
It's not that clear cut. I mean, one of the big arguments for and against the open office space is the ease of communication. And this also plays in very heavily to remote working, but I don't know anything about that, so I'll skip that for now. When you have an open environment, you can very easily take your headphones off, look at somebody across the room from you or next to you, and ask them a question. Or, you know, wait for them to take their headphones off right. And then ask them the question.
So you can have a quick 2-minute meeting, or you solve a problem, or you show somebody something, an interface you design, and it's instantaneous and it's personal, and you're right there with the person.
Right. This is a double-edged sword, because what this also means is that it's really, really easy for you to ask somebody a question that you could have found the answer to yourself with a few minutes of Googling or looking through your own code or their own code. Or documentation. it basically makes it easier for you to ask someone else a question than for you to find the answer out yourself in a lot of cases. What that also means is that it's easier for you to distract somebody and knock them out of their concentration. And that's bad. And so there's a lot of little problems that go along with ease of communication in an open office setting, where if you're right next to somebody, you can bug them a lot. And they can bug you a lot. and everybody can bug you a lot. And it's really easy for, like, you know, if three people are gathering looking at something on somebody's screen two desks down from you, you're going to see that out of the corner of your eye, and you're going to wonder what that is, and you're going to get out of your concentration too and go over there. So it not only is it really easy to distract one person, it's really easy to distract everybody at once. Or even, like, you know, if you can see the front door to your office from your desk, you know, the UPS guy walks in and you see that every single time. So every time anybody orders anything from Amazon to get shipped to work because they can't sign for it at home because UPS never delivers during hours or anybody can actually sign for anything at their house if they work. Anytime anybody gets anything delivered, you notice and it knocks you out of your concentration and you might want to go and check to see if it's a thing you ordered or not. So there's lots of distraction potential in an open office. That being said, if you have the traditional setup of individual offices with walls and doors, you can still walk over and ask somebody a question, but it's harder. It takes more effort. You have to go, and like, if you have to knock on a closed door, that, if you have any social skills at all, feels like more of an imposition. So you might be a little bit more hesitant to go bother somebody with a really simple question if, like, their door is closed and you have to go knock to have them answer something for you. Anyway, all that aside, though, when you are truly collaborating with somebody on something, being that close to them in person and being able to work next to them is really useful. So I can't really say for sure that I would ever want a closed office. If I was working on a team, I've never had a closed office before, but I really can't say for sure whether I would prefer that. Because, like, at Tumblr, I was constantly working with other people.
Right.
All the people who sat right around me. And it was really helpful to be able to just work together on something and to, like, sketch something out or just talk through a quick implementation detail or something. Like, it really was very valuable. And it also doesn't, you know, it feels less lonely. Like, you know, you don't feel isolated. You feel like you're part of a team. You don't just feel like you're going to a room for no reason in this building that you could do from home. So there is value to the open office in addition to the cost savings. It also is nicer when you are collaborating, even though it's more distracting when you're trying not to collaborate. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's caught on so much, because there's this benefit. And, you know, as, like, all these various methodologies have spread throughout business books and programmer conferences, like Agile, I don't know anything about any of these things, but they tend to emphasize working together and
right. Pair programming and
right.
Scrum.
So, like, as far as I know, almost all those methodologies work better or require the open office setup. So, you know, if you're the reason why this is spreading so much and why it's pretty much universal in startups especially and in web companies is because it's cheap and it's practical and it might even be the best way to do it for productivity. We don't, you know, that's kind of up in the air. But so, you know, it isn't just like a bleak office cost saving measure. There actually is potential value to it. And so, you know, overall, I've only ever worked in cubicles and the more open office settings.
Yeah.
I've never worked in close. So I really don't know the whole, and I've never worked from home remotely. I mean, now I work at home just for myself, but I'm not really collaborating with anybody. So
right.
I don't really face those issues. Yeah, it's totally different.
A lot of people who do work from home, especially for themselves, will complain about things like, isolation or feeling like they don't have connection to the outside world. They're becoming a hermit. They're that kind of thing. I've heard the people who work remotely for another company complaining about similar things. But I think, having done all of it, I have very limited exposure to the open office. It was so horrible that anytime I was faced with that, I would find a way to find another job or not have to do it. So horrible. But everything else, cubes, private offices, working from home remotely, working for myself, I've done all of it. And, I think it just comes down to the fact that there's everybody works differently. And I think there's pluses and minuses to really to all of those options. There's everybody listening to this is going to say, I love working in an open office. It's the most wonderful thing ever. I would hate working in an office. And there's other people like, if I can't shut my door, I can't work. You know, I think the problem is that as a company, as the owner of a company, or in a position where if you're the, you know, manager of spatial planning for the company, whatever, somebody has to make that decision where they have to look at costs on the one hand, they have to look at preference on the other hand, and they're going to make a decision, and the decision is what they think is going to be the best across the board. What can we afford? What would we like to do for the employees? What is the compromise? And it seems like today, nowadays, the compromise is usually do the open office thing. And there are some people that just cannot or do not ever want to work that way. And there's other people who really thrive on it. And in fact, like you were mentioning, whether it's Scrum or pair programming or whatever, there are some methods of software development anyway that almost require that. And I don't know, because I don't have any experience with it either. But I hear that those kinds of pair programming can be really, really effective and you can really get stuff done. I don't know. I've never done the comparison. You know what I do know? Our second sponsor, Shopify.com, the internet's most elegant, customizable, scalable hosted e-commerce platform. Now, these guys actually do have a pretty amazing office. I wonder if I can find some pictures of this. Toby, the guy that founded up this thing, they're up in Canada. Amazing offices.
They have offices up there.
They do. It's hard to believe. But the reason that they have such a cool office is, I think, because they're such a good company. Here's what they let you do. You get your own online store. You can accept credit cards. You can use your own domain or theirs. Doesn't matter. I like to use my own. You customize your store's design, and then they host it all for you. You don't need to worry about security. You don't need to worry about any of that. They do everything. There's no software to download. They've got tons and tons of HTML and CSS templates for you. Do you know what PCI DSS is? Are you 100% compliant? Don't know what it is? Don't worry about it. They do that. You can trust Shopify with your business. They're the best. I love them. Go to Shopify.com, okay, and you'll get your first 3 months free. 3 months free if you use code 5x5. Check them out, Shopify.com.
Wait, how many months was that? That was free?
3.
Oh, okay.
Normally it's 1. If you just went there and signed up, 1.
Good deal.
It is a good deal.
And I would hate to write my own shop code.
It'd kill you.
That sounds like a nightmare, to be honest.
It's the worst.
I'm very happy to outsource that, like, you know, dealing with all the credit cards and, oh my God, that would be horrible. Have you ever actually looked into what PCI compliance is? It's crazy.
It's something you don't want to have to worry about.
Yeah. It's like you have to like store half the credit card numbers in one server that's behind a lock and key and store the other half in a separate collection with different locks and keys. And it's ridiculous what you have to do. It's much better to outsource it to somebody else. Anyway, I would like to talk a little bit about how to make the most of an open office, because I think that's really going to help people who aren't us. Because right now, we are barely qualified to talk about it. Because you said you've hardly ever worked in an open setting because you hated it so much. I've worked a lot in an open setting, but the last time was a year ago, and getting further away every minute. So, but I do think that is probably the most common environment for people who are listening to this.
Yeah.
In all likelihood, I think. If you have the opportunity to make choices, you know, you probably don't. You're probably powerless. The choices are probably made for you. But if you have any kind of input that you can give on the desks, the furniture, the dividers, if there are any. One thing we had at my first company I worked for, Vivissimo in Pittsburgh, we had these dividers. Can you hear that rain?
It doesn't come through. Plus, I've got the noise gate on you, so it cuts off that kind of thing.
It's very loud.
Is it like a torrential downpour?
Yeah, and it's a downpour on this tremendous single pane skylight right above my head. So it's very loud.
Do you lose a lot of heat to that in the winter?
Yes, a lot. So, anyway, So, you know, if you have input, what I had at the very first company I worked for out of college were these great kind of half height dividers. They're probably about maybe 2 feet tall. And it was like partially fogged glass, but the fog layer was sandwiched between two glass layers. So on both sides, you could write on them with a whiteboard marker and just wipe it off. Like usually those fog layers, it's like a rough, like a sanded layer. Usually you can't write directly on that because you can't wipe it off. If you sandwich it between two layers of flat glass, both sides can be used as whiteboards. So that was really cool. And it still let a lot of light through. You didn't feel too isolated like you do with cubicle walls. That was cool. I've also worked without dividers. And generally, it isn't that bad these days if you're a coder because you probably have a huge monitor or two. And monitors kind of form their own walls these days at the sizes that we're all using. So, I mean, if you're still stuck on a 17-inch, I'm sorry, this won't work for you. But if you have like a 24-inch or a 30-inch or if you have two monitors, you're probably doing a pretty good job of making a wall yourself. And so you might not even need any kind of divider. And the reason why dividers are important is that it's useful to not have, as I said earlier with like the UPS guy coming in the front door, it's useful to reduce visual distraction.
Right.
Because you can very easily put on headphones and block out audio distractions, but it's a lot harder to block out visual distractions. And so, yeah, there's that. I would also suggest, just for my own comfort level, I always found that I didn't like being in a position in the open setup where a lot of people could see what's on my screen.
Yeah, because you're looking at porn and stuff.
Constantly, yeah. So, you know, I didn't want to be like, I didn't want to be like across from the front door facing into a wall with my monitor facing out into the room, you know, because that like everyone can see that. I just felt really self-conscious about like having pages up and people reading what's on my screen. You know, I couldn't, that made me uneasy. And if it makes you uneasy too, you know, keep that in mind if you pick your cubicle location or if you're rearranging. I found that I was a little bit uneasy if I couldn't see the front door at all. Like I wanted the front door to be in my field of view because sometimes people would come in and like everyone was in their headphones. And so people would kind of like walk around trying to act like they were okay and didn't pay any attention, but they really needed somebody to like greet them. And, you know, and that was so awkward. That happened a few times. I'm like, all right, I got to at least be available and know what's going on. Also, like, you know, at some of the jobs, we've had like giant servers delivered that I had to take care of. So, you know, there were occasionally like I had to be kind of attentive to package deliveries and things like that. Beyond that, I don't know. Do you have any strategies for making the most of an open setup? I mean, really, my biggest suggestion is get headphones. I mean, that's mandatory.
And either play
whatever you play in them.
Play whatever it is that makes you feel good.
Yeah, play Fish, play crappy Beastie Boys. I don't care.
As long as you feel good about your environment. And see, that's the other problem is lighting, and that to me was always a side. I would even in some cases put that above noise. See, if once you have kids, your tolerance for noise completely changes, unless your kids are like really weird and quiet and they just stare, you know, and then don't make any sound. Most kids, I think, make a lot of noise. Mine, certainly. My boy makes enough noise for the whole neighborhood. And you very quickly learn to, I don't want to say tune it out, but your sensitivity to noise that you don't control changes. Here's an example.
That makes sense.
If I went to a restaurant and like, let's say two or three tables down, there's some kid yelling, laughing, bouncing, you know, banging his fork on the thing, dropping the bunny on the ground, got to cry again, bunny, you know, whatever. And the parents just kind of semi-ignoring the kid. And like, why aren't they giving, all the kid wants is their attention. Why aren't they looking at the kid? Why don't they talk to the kid? And so that's bad parenting, sure. But that whole dialogue and the kid and the noise the kid would be making, if I'm sitting there, you know, at a business meeting with another person, or if I'm there with my wife on a, you know, a date night or something, that would drive me nuts. It'd be like, Dinner was ruined because this kid wouldn't shut up the whole time. A horrible meal. Now, if I even notice the kid, this is not even going to bug me, and it won't even bug me if they're in the seat right behind me. I can sit on the occasional times that I have to, you know, sit on an airplane or something, and there's a kid behind me throwing stuff, kicking my seat. I don't even feel it. I don't even notice it. It's relaxing.
Interesting.
All that changes when you have kids, especially
because
if
right now, I'm the kind of person now, like, that would really matter to me. Like, I would notice
that. It would
ruin
your whole day.
It would ruin the meal.
Yeah.
Like, it would be very distracting to me, but I don't have kids yet. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, you very well may find that you still hate it, but most parents that I know, like, I remember this, but some of our friends had kids before us, and I'd be over their house, and the kid would be like spinning around on the ground, throwing stuff in the air, and he'd just be sort of nonchalantly talking to me about, you know, the game over the weekend or something. I'd be like, "Is she all right?" And he'd be like, "Why? What happened?" I'd be like, "Well, she's going nuts." He's like, "I don't even hear it.
I don't even hear it."
And, you know, I'm not saying that that's always the case, but I'm saying your tolerance changes. For me, though, lighting. I have always, I mean, fluorescent lights, I think, are the worst. And you go into, you know, a lot of developers, like, they want to be in the dark anyway. So I think in a purely development environment, it wouldn't be weird to find some maybe more dim lighting. But I'll tell you what, you walk into one of those rooms, one of those buildings, and all the lights are on, and they're fluorescent, and they're bright because they're, you know, 15-foot-plus ceilings, and they got to make them bright enough for you to see down at the desk. And these things are, I don't know how people sit under fluorescent lights. I used to get the worst headaches from that. Oh my gosh. It's just the worst thing in the world. And for me, that's something that you can get the best headphones in the world that completely enclose your ear, and you can play Fish, like you said, or whatever you want to. But that lighting, you can't get away from it. You can't get away from that. And then you got to be the weird guy who stands up on your desk eventually and turn, you know, unscrew, if you're lucky enough to be able to reach him, unscrews the fluorescent lights over
You were one of those guys?
I had to.
That's awesome.
I would get such bad headaches from it. I would get headaches. I'd have to, you know, go home and lay down for the rest of the day. It was horrible. And I would unscrew it. And then you get to deal with maintenance who would come down every couple of weeks. Yeah, we got to report the lights are out. Yeah, I turned them off. Okay, we're going to put new ones in. No, they're fine. I just, you know, because all you have to do is
some kind of safety issue.
You stand up there and you give it a quarter turn, and it'll you know, disconnect the fluorescent tube from the thing, and eventually they just stopped coming. But that was the worst, because, like I said, you can't get away from that noise. You can do a lot to isolate it, but the lighting, and there's plenty of people who don't like that kind of light. I don't know anybody that likes the fluorescent lighting.
I think I've actually been pretty lucky. I'm trying to think. As far as I know, besides my little summer internship at Nationwide with like the giant cubicle farm in Ohio, besides that, I don't think any of my other workplaces were lit only by fluorescent lighting. Like, the Tumblr office had these big fluorescent tubes that not the ones that shine directly down, but they were hanging on from posts from the ceiling, and the lights pointed up, so they were diffused by the ceiling. And that was only the secondary light in the room. The primary light was a bunch of incandescent lights with these little globes around them hanging down. So I don't think I've ever been in a place that was only fluorescent. I think I've always had incandescent, because you always have to go around and replace all the stupid bulbs because they burn out constantly. So they were definitely incandescents. But, you know, all fluorescent light is bad, but I also don't like coding in the dark. Like,
a lot of people don't like that, and it's hard.
Really
hard on your eyes, right?
I would, yeah, I think so. I mean, like, I like a good amount of light. It doesn't have to be fluorescent, but I also don't want it to be dim. You know, I really want a good amount of light, because otherwise I want to fall asleep. You know, to me, like, working in a dim environment all day would be depressing, and I'd be tired. I'd want to just take a nap. I don't know.
Right. No, I mean, that's legitimate. I mean, and there's some of the people in the chat room were saying, "Oh, I can't work in the dark. I feel sleepy." Yeah, right there. Arrogance.
There
arrogance says, "Oh man, I can't stay alert and code all day in the dark. I get sleepy."
I think it's pronounced arrogant.
Arrogant?
Arrogant.
But it's very true. It's very true. I mean, you know, and it's not, I don't think it's good. You're supposed to get sunlight, right? We're like people. We're not supposed to be in the dark.
Right. There's vitamin something that you need to get from the sun.
That's right. Something. So, I mean, that's not an answer either, but it's, you know, like right now, I've got west facing windows here and in this place. And it, you don't really get direct sun at any point in the day, and it's kind of west. It's not really west, I guess it's northwest. But you get a, you know, it's great, and I can have the whole room, even in the summertime, windows open, and I get tons of light in here, and it's great. This is the best sort of space I've had lighting wise ever in any place I've ever worked right now. But it is really important, I think, and people don't often get the choice. It's just tough. I think the whole concept of the office at every step of the way, it's a compromise, and somebody doesn't like something about what's going on. One person doesn't like the noise.
You got like thermostat person.
Oh yeah,
that make like, and they eventually install the fake thermostats that don't do anything, just to get, just as placebos, like the door close button in elevators.
I knew about the door close button. I've always heard that the thermostats are not real, but you never know.
I mean, they're usually real in the sense that they are really measuring the temperature and sending some kind of signal to a central control unit, but central control unit can be programmed to ignore them. And that is often done in offices. Problem, people never know how to use thermostats. Like they'll go to a room and like, "Oh, it's hot in here." And they'll go and turn the thermostat down like 10 degrees. And then like 10 degrees later, it's freezing in the room and someone goes, "Oh my God, I'm freezing." And they go turn it up.
Right.
10 degrees.
Right.
And, like, no, cause no one realizes like just, okay, if you, this is why people shouldn't have control. Like, all right, move it to a good temperature and just leave it there.
Right.
When you come in from jogging, you will be warm.
Right.
Just wait a minute and you will cool off and you'll be fine. Yeah. I don't like thermostats.
Mm. Well, we should talk. Don't you have a Nest now anyway?
I do. I actually have two of them, but...
we should talk about that. We don't have enough time.
Not today. I haven't spent enough time with it, honestly. I need like another month with it to really form a good opinion.
I can't wait to hear about it. We should probably wrap this one up.
Yep, let's do it.
This is a great episode, and I think this is our last episode of 2011.
See you next year.
Yeah, see you next year. So have a happy, safe new year to you.
And did I make that joke last year too? Probably.
Oh no, I'll have to roll back the tape.
Let's see.
All right, Marco, have a good one.
You too, Dan.